presented by Pharma.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Playbook co-author Ryan Lizza. It's Friday, May 31st, and there's only one thing driving the day. Donald Trump is a convicted felon. Yesterday, 12 jurors in Manhattan found the former president guilty on all 34 counts of falsifying business records. After the news broke, I got together with Ankush Kardori, a senior writer and columnist for Politico magazine, and senior legal affairs reporter Kyle Chaney to help us understand the verdict, this historic moment, and what happens next. Here's part of that conversation. All right, so Kyle, you were inside the courtroom today. Let's start with you. Just set the scene for us as the jury entered the room to deliver this verdict.
Sure. So the moment really started just before they came in because everyone was packing up to go home for the day. We were all convinced that, I mean, there had been no word from the jury at all. And the judge, Juan Merchan, even said, "We're going home. We're going to send the jury home at 4:30. They're not going to have a decision today." He left to go check on them, and then he was gone for a while. And we were all like, "What's taking so long?" Suddenly, he comes back and says, "Actually, we're not going home today. There's a verdict." So it was this kind of whiplash moment that I think added to the suspense and the drama of it, which was already high, of course. But then, of course, you had the jury come out. And they confirmed they had reached their verdict. You had this moment where people were wondering, is the jury stuck? Are they fighting? Is there a holdout that's going to make this a protracted deliberation, maybe into next week? And so I think we were all adjusting our mindsets for that to be the reality, which is why when they said, "Actually, we're done, and here's this historic verdict minutes away," it was really kind of, a whiplash moment.
Got it. Okay, so explain to people your vantage point watching this unfold.
Sure. So I was in the overflow room of the courthouse, which is where the majority of the press corps is situated. There are some people in the courtroom itself. But in fact, I actually prefer the overflow room because you have a screen where you can see Donald Trump's face. You can't see the jurors. You can't see the jury by design, but you can see Donald Trump. And so the biggest thing is, what's his reaction to this going to be? You're not seeing the jury, but you're hearing the judge address them and say, "You've reached a verdict." They confirm that. And then they just went through very businesslike, orderly, one by one, count one, guilty, count two, guilty. And of course, the first one is the moment, because it almost doesn't matter what happened to the other 33 counts, though they all turned out to be guilty. But you get the first one, you say, he's a convicted felon now. That is sort of the history of that moment, and the power of that moment was immediate. And of course, you could feel it in the courthouse because it was so tense.
Fascinating. All right, Ankush, I want to let's talk about the case. I like having the two of you on because we're probably going to be as politics free as a conversation like this can be, because I personally just don't think we know the political fallout here. So I want to start with this question. How did the prosecution win this case?
Gosh, well, I mean, look, it looks like they managed to win this case by persuading jurors that Michael Cohen was credible enough on the key elements of his testimony, including descriptions of some key conversations that he had with Trump for which there were no other witnesses. And also by, shoring up his testimony by sort of beating home this theme that he was being corroborated by documents and other witnesses, text messages, financial records and things like that. And that was mostly true. It wasn't entirely true that his testimony could be fully corroborated by other evidence in the case, but a lot of it could. And, I think that strategy looks like it paid off. I don't think it's actually much of a surprise. Well, it is a surprise anytime you get a jury note. But the fact that they asked about circumstantial evidence in particular, I thought was a good sign for the prosecution, because that kind of was a key component of their case, which is, presenting this as a story that just made logical sense and logically led to a conviction. I think that they had a pretty fulsome and consistent narrative that they sort of unspooled over the course of the trial. It had its gaps and weaknesses in my estimation, but it does appear to be the case that the jurors sort of accepted it.
All right, Ankush, this is a subject that's near and dear to your heart, I believe. And that is, the flip side is, how did the defense blow this?
Yeah, this is actually a very similar to the end of a political campaign, right? Where everybody sort of retroactively decides like that the winner was a genius the whole time and the loser was destined to lose the whole time. Same thing kind of happens in a trial too. So I don't want to oversell it, but I do think like even in the moment as the pretrial proceedings and the trial proceedings unfolded, there were just some very conspicuous missteps. In the run up to the trial, I mean, they just could not stop talking in their court filings about how they thought that Donald Trump was being persecuted by the Democrats and the Biden administration, this, that, or the other. That was for public consumption, obviously, but it went to the judge too. And it made all of their briefs weaker and easier to kind of set to the side. I never felt like the briefs actually did a particularly effective job, the defense's briefs, a particularly effective job of explaining just how much there was in the way of sort of new prosecutorial sort of imagination here, if you will, not to suggest that it was inappropriate or anything, but a lot of this was untested in the architecture of the legal case. Then as we got to the trial, you know, I did a whole column on this. I mean, it was just a completely idiotic for Todd Blanche, Trump's lead counsel, to deny that Trump had had a sexual encounter with Stormy Daniels. I mean, they were just asking to get beaten over the head with her testimony. That's exactly what happened. The cross of Stormy Daniels was just terrible, long, protracted. It's a really bad sign when on day two, the witness starts effectively making fun of you and tossing one-liners back to you. Throughout, you know, there were also these cross-examinations of every single witness. Again, this is a very Trumpian strategy, right? You just have to like, you know, attack everything. Don't, you know, deny everything. And, you know, the early witnesses, we'll take someone like Keith Davidson, who was Stormy Daniels' lawyer. He barely had any contact with, I mean, he had no contact with Trump. His dealings were all through Michael Cohen. So, you know, the cross of him could have been, you know, how many times you talked to Donald Trump? Okay, zero or some variation on that. Instead, it was like this whole thing about how he's a sleaze merchant and potentially extorted Trump and all that. And it was like, you know, that may be good for sort of the political theater, but it is not the way to defend a white collar case, which usually requires some very strategic judgments about what to contest and what not to contest. And then we get to the cross of Michael Cohen, which I think was always sort of the main event in this case. And, you know, Cohen has just so much I've never seen a government witness in any serious criminal prosecution with as much material for a defense lawyer to work with as Michael Cohen.
All right, gentlemen, my last question here is that now that Donald Trump is a convicted felon, what are all the ways in which being a convicted felon will affect his life? So about asking you the political question that, you know, we're all going to be debating over the next few weeks in terms of what this means for the election, but what does it mean to be a convicted felon for him?
Good question. I think being a convicted felon for Trump is going to mean something different than it would for most people in the world, as a lot of things are, you know. I got a text message while we're on this podcast, which I'm a political prisoner, you know, donate here. And, you know, I think they'll make hay out of this for a while, in part because what we just talked about, you know, there's a good chance this sentence will be suspended pending appeal. And he may not feel a real consequence from this for quite a while. And so I think for Trump, it's always the moment of where the actual consequence hits is the real moment that matters to him, as opposed to, you know, the fallout from the bad headlines about being convicted. There's a lot of Trumpologists out there, I think the term Politico coined back in the day, who probably, you know, that I think a conviction for him hits him in a psychic, you know, ego bruising sort of way. That even if he thinks the trial is rigged and unfair, is gonna hurt him to his core, something he's been afraid of his entire life. But that said, I don't know if he's not gonna be the typical convicted felon who has too many restrictions on his travel or his movements. I'm very curious how they factor in, because the court system is not supposed to factor in the political side of things, whether they account for the fact that he'll be in the home stretch of a campaign when his sentence is supposed to be effectuated, and that actually trying to sentence him to prison in that moment might be have bigger repercussions than just putting someone in jail.
Look, in the ordinary course, you know, there might be some collateral effects in terms of like his ability to vote in Florida. I know that there's a story on that we have up on that subject on the site. And, you know, other than that, right, like, what does it mean to be a felon? Well, it's usually harder to get a job if you're looking for a job, but he's not going to have that problem. It's supposed to be a huge stigma, and an embarrassing thing, but we'll see if that is the case here. Certainly, he's not going to present himself as someone feeling like he's suffered some actual stigma. So, and I agree with Kyle. I wouldn't expect much in the way of like any types of restrictions on his movements or anything like that, or any sort of particularly onerous conditions on him. You know, but you know, we'll see. I mean, like if he's in office when that happens, then I don't think there will really be any effect while he's in office.
You can listen to our entire conversation now on Playbook Deep Dive. And for your schedule today, the Senate and the House are out. And this afternoon, President Biden will welcome Prime Minister Alexander De Croo of Belgium for a meeting at the White House. Later, he welcomes the Super Bowl champion, Kansas City Chiefs, to the White House. And we'll be waiting today to see if the president addresses the Trump verdict. The music in today's show was composed by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Kellen Tanzel-Suddeth is our podcast producer. Annie Reese is managing producer. Mike DeBonis and Zach Stanton are our editors. I'm Ryan Lizza. Thanks for listening.
The 340B drug pricing program is supposed to help vulnerable patients access medicines at qualifying hospitals and clinics. It's meant to be a safety net for those who really need it. Instead, 340B is padding the profits of PBMs, chain pharmacies, and big hospitals. Let's fix 340B so it can help the patients that need it most. Visit phrma.org/340B to learn more.